This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. I'm Yeheyis Wuhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We had an incredible engagement of faith leaders coming from the region to Niger, stepping forward to say war is not the answer, to say diplomacy must be first and foremost.
That was Emera Woods, the executive director of the Green Leadership Trust, about efforts to peacefully reverse Niger's coup. Details coming up. Also, members of the U.S. Congress are critical of Tunisia's president. And Doctors Without Borders warns of worsening healthcare situation in Sudan. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. In Ghana, West African military chiefs have wrapped 2 days of talks in which they discussed preparations for a possible armed intervention in Niger after a coup there ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. The Economic Community of West African States has agreed to activate a standby force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. ECOWAS defense chiefs were meeting in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, to fine-tune details of the potential military operation if negotiations with coup leaders fail. Also, today, the United States military said it is making precautionary plans to evacuate 2 drone and counter-terrorism bases in Niger. Air Force General James Hecker told reporters no decision has been made to evacuate the bases, since seen as key to supporting regional efforts to combat Islamist extremists attacking governments and communities across Africa's Sahel region. 3 weeks into the coup in Niger, the military junta continues to cling to power, while West African army chiefs hold a second day of talks in Ghana to determine whether their next course of action is diplomacy or a military intervention. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo reports on the choices confronting Africa's regional leaders.
West African defense ministers held a second day of talks on Friday in Ghana's capital, Accra, where they're mapping out a possible military intervention if diplomacy fails to reinstate Niger's deposed president, Mohamed Bazoum. Reda Liamouri, an analyst who has done a lot of fieldwork in the Sahel Lake Chad Basin, says the West African bloc ECOWAS is in a difficult position, trying to discourage coups in the region, but grappling with whether diplomacy or military intervention is the best deterrent.
At the moment, there are still some divisions and in terms of the military intervention, not only between the ECOWAS and the African Union, but also among the ECOWAS members, as well as, of course, the position of regional members that are excluded from these meetings, who are currently run by junta, by military regimes like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea.
Liamouri, also a senior fellow at the Policy Center New South, a Moroccan-based policy research firm in Washington, told VOA, a military intervention could not only be catastrophic to Niger, but also to other countries in the already volatile region. And he says it could spill over beyond the Sahel.
I think North African countries do have a role to play in terms of their diplomatic efforts to try to play the peacemaker, bring everyone to the table to find the solution that is going to be less damaging to the region, because North Africa would be concerned if there is a military intervention because of border. Algeria specifically, but also there are a lot of economic and diplomatic ties between North Africa and Niger and West Africa in general. Morocco has a lot of economic interests with Niger itself. We know in terms of like food security, the renovation and remodeling of the capital Niamey efforts, in addition to other businesses like in terms of telecom. insurance, banking, etc.
Emira Woods is the executive director of the Green Leadership Trust and also a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She applauds the recent efforts by regional religious leaders who visited Niamey.
We had an incredible engagement of faith leaders coming from the region to Niger, stepping forward to say war is not the answer, to say diplomacy must be first and foremost, to find a path to the democratic process.
Wood says it's time for African unity and directly points the finger at the West.
What we have before us is an incredible juxtaposition of international community with its interest and focus on resources, particularly the uranium that's in Niger, building up military forces, training, equipping those military forces.
Most Western countries have condemned the coup and have thrown their support behind efforts by the African Union and the ECOWAS bloc. Niger holds strategic economic and geopolitical significance internationally. Uranium and oil, two natural resources plentiful in Niger, are sought after in the international commodities market. And under President Bazoum, the country was a big ally to the West in the fight against insurgency groups in the region linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group. Junta leaders have justified toppling the democratically elected president because they accused them of not handling rampant insecurity in some parts of the country. On Wednesday, 17 of its soldiers were killed in an ambush by insurgents about 60 kilometers from the Niger capital, Niamey, in an area that borders Burkina Faso.
What we have is an undermining of peace and security in the region that goes back to the NATO invasion and the ouster of Gaddafi in Libya, and the flow of weapons into Libya, then from Libya throughout the region in the Sahel. What we have is a steady equipping of military actors and making it literally laying the groundwork for these military actors to gain power, strength, visibility, and legitimacy in a way that has emboldened them to launch coups from Mali to Burkina to now Niger. And of course, you have a similar situation on the other side of the Sahel in the Sudan region.
Sudan's two rival generals have been engaged in a brutal war against each other the past 4 months with no end in sight. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Some members of the U.S. House of Representatives have put forward a resolution recognizing Tunisia's leadership in the Arab Spring, but also accusing Tunisian President Kais Saied of derailing democratic transition in Tunisia. Radwan Masmoudi, president for the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington, discussed the resolution with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Among the topics they covered were the major criticisms the resolution makes of Saied.
The House Resolution 613, which is being discussed right now in the House of Representatives, I think is a very important statement by the members of Congress. It's a statement of support to democracy. It condemns and strongly criticizes everything that Qais Saied has done in Tunisia since the coup of July 25, 2021. That was almost exactly 2 years ago. And the resolution lists all the actions that he has taken in these 2 years. He has dismantled so many institutions, such as, of course, the constitution itself, such as the parliament itself, the political parties, the civil society organizations, the freedom of expression and of the media, the lawyers, the right of the lawyers and the judges, basically everything he can to control every lever of power and control the state and therefore undermine democracy. And that's why I think this is a very important statement by members of Congress condemning this and urging him to return to democracy. It recognizes Tunisia as the symbolic birthplace of the historic Arab Spring movement, and it recognizes Tunisia's notable democratic reforms that emerged after that Arab Spring period. It commends the Tunisian people for their courage and their democratic achievements made in the immediate years following the Arab Spring. And finally, it calls on the government of Tunisia to release all political prisoners, to respect the rights of the people to free exercise of peaceful assembly and expression, to protect the right of association and the right of the civil society to operate without government interference. And it calls on the Tunisian government to organize and support transparent and open presidential, parliamentary, and municipal election processes, including with regard to the presidential election scheduled for 2024, for next year.
So what's the next step, and how significant is passing such a resolution in U.S. Congress?
I think the resolution itself is a message. It expresses the thinking and the mindset of the majority of the members of Congress regarding what's happening in Tunisia. And the goal of the resolution is to send a message to Tunisian authorities, to Qais Saied himself, but not only to Qais Saied, to everyone around him, to the Tunisian military, to the Tunisian government, and I think to the Tunisian people as a whole, that the Congress stands with democracy and will do everything it can to support democracy in Tunisia. There is another bill also being considered in the Senate, which is very similar in language to this bill in the House. But the bill in the Senate is actually a bill, not just a resolution, but a bill that will limit all kinds of assistance to Tunisia. The bill proposes to basically zero out military support and military assistance to Tunisia, and to reduce economic assistance, to limit it to only 25% of whatever amount has been decided in the budget. So I think there is a will in both the House and the Senate to send a message to the Tunisian government, but also to exert increasing pressure on the government of Tunisia to return to democratic norms and to respect the democratic procedures. I think Qais Saied is growing very isolated, both inside Tunisia and outside of Tunisia.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president for the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington. He spoke by phone with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shinawi. In Sudan, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, says violence is threatening Al Nawa Hospital in the town of Omdurman, which MSF supports. Farouk Osig, MSF Emergency Coordinator in Sudan, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam it's one of the few health facilities that continues to treat trauma patients as the fighting intensifies in parts of the country between the Sudan Army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces.
At the moment in Omdurman, in the northern part, there are only a couple of hospitals still functioning, and our hospital is the one that is receiving all the trauma patients and the critical patients' medical cases, because the other hospital that is still functioning is Al-Buluk Hospital, which is a pediatric hospital, and Saudi Hospital, that had to change its location after a staff member was shot in the hospital and is now moved to Al Nawa Hospital in the same location, which is a maternity hospital that is providing safe spaces for women to give safe deliveries. And Al Nawa Hospital is receiving all kinds of cases, so we're supporting mainly the emergency room, and Al Nawa is receiving from violent trauma cases to non-violent trauma cases, but also all other medical cases, whether someone has a stroke or a heart attack or any other condition, they would come to our hospital.
Can you describe some of the trauma type injuries that they're seeing at the hospital?
Well, it's all kind of trauma that one can imagine. So it starts with, there are still traffic accidents, there are still people falling and having non-violent related trauma. But then we do see violent-related trauma as well, and that's gunshot wounds, that's shrapnel wounds, that is a stabbing wound, whatever one can imagine.
Are the staff there telling you that a lot of these patients that are coming in with the gunshot wounds, I mean, are women and children too?
Yes. We have received quite a number of children that either had gunshot wounds or had shrapnel wounds or wounds from other devices or other weapons that would be stabilized in Anao, and then are referred to other hospitals for surgeries that can't be done, for example, in Anao Hospital. I did see some of the patients that have been referred to another location in River Nile State, where I was able to go and see some of these patients that have been referred from Anao for further surgery.
Well, as this heavy fighting continues in and around Omdurman and Khartoum, elsewhere around the country to Darfur, what is MSF asking for?
MSF is asking, as usual, that first of all, the medical facilities and the medical staff in the facilities is able to treat patients and is spared from any violence and is enjoying the protected status that they should have as medical personnel and medical facilities. But then we're also asking for the warring parties to respect the protection of civilians, especially when it comes to children who are innocent, have nothing to do with the conflict, have nothing to do with any background of the conflict, but are affected heavily.
Thank you, Frauke. Is there anything you want to mention that you feel is important I haven't asked you?
Well, it's just amazing what the medical staff is doing under these difficult circumstances. So they are affected, their families are affected, they have problems sometimes to reach the hospital or to leave the hospital after they have been doing a 12 or 24-hour shift and are running double shifts to just be there to support the population.
That's Frauke Aussig, MSF Emergency Coordinator in Sudan, speaking from Port Sudan with my colleague Carol Van Dam. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. A Libyan militia leader whose detention sparked clashes that killed 55 people in the capital Tripoli this week has been released, while Mahmoud Hamza's release has halted the fighting for now. Analysts say the underlying tensions remain unchanged, with the deaths, injuries and territorial shifts only likely to fan the flames of division and hostility. For VOA, Noura Hafaidi has more from Tripoli.
Gun battles had raged on the streets of Tripoli from Monday night through Tuesday after Triple Brigade militia leader Mohammed Hamza was apprehended by the rival Tripoli militia, al-Rad'a Force. Fighting broke out in the capital after Hamza's detention on Monday, killing 55 people, wounding 146, and forcing the closure of the capital's only civilian airport, the worst armed clashes seen in Libya for a year. Hamza was released on Wednesday night and returned to his headquarters south of Tripoli. Ahmed Galboun is an advisor to Libyan Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah.
The situation now, after the intervention of the Prime Minister, Mr. Abdelhamid Dbeibah, Mr. Mohammed Hamza was handed over to neutral party. And within a short period of time, the military operation stopped and the life returned to normal.
Galboun added that Hamza was released under a government-sponsored ceasefire agreement, which also provides for the withdrawal of fighters from the front lines. He said the Prime Minister is assessing the situation and planning to compensate Libyans who were affected by the violent clashes. The situation is stable, with police patrols deployed in areas that had seen fighting, allowing people to move around. Condemnation and calls for peace have begun to roll in from key international and political actors. The United Nations support mission in Libya, UNSMIL, said it was following the security incidents with concern and called on all parties to protect civilians. It also expressed concern about the possible impact of these developments on the political process and called for an immediate de-escalation. Meanwhile, the French, UK, United States, Italian, and European Union embassies expressed concern about the clashes and their impact on civilians, reiterating UNSMIL's call for de-escalation. The House of Representatives in eastern Libya condemned the hostilities, saying it holds the Government of National Unity, GNU, the Presidential Council, and armed groups in the capital responsible for the chaos. Ahmed Shibani, president of the Libyan Democratic Party, expressed his concern about the impact of the clashes on Libyan security and the future of the elections.
The short-lived sense of stability has been shattered. The current conflict in Tripoli is artificially induced by those who wish to subvert the success of the Arab Spring. As a matter of fact, the real intended target of the recent high traffic of stray bullets in southern Tripoli is the ballot box.
He added that, in his view, too many foreign hands are disrupting the troubled transition to democracy in Libya. A period of relative stability had led the United Nations to express hope for delayed elections to be held this year. Ihab Abbas is a North African political analyst.
Definitely and obviously, these clashes in Libya will leave this country in more vulnerable and fragile situation, especially security situations. And unfortunately, this will make the political vision very vague during the coming time.
Abbas added that whether clashes resume or not, the violence is likely to further crystallize existing divisions and alliances among other Tripoli armed groups, and if fighting were to resume and intensify, it could draw them into the wider western region. He says the situation in Tripoli is likely to remain very volatile for the immediate term and could escalate further. I am Mohammed El-Shenawi for Nour Al-Fayed in Tunis.
And just moments ago, the military chiefs of ECOWAS finished their meeting. They told journalists in Ghana, the military option is not our preferred option, but they are obliged to do it because of the intransigence of the Niger junta. He says we are ready to go into Niger anytime the order is given. He describes the Niger's coup as one too many. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, we are experiencing a global hunger crisis of unprecedented proportions. According to the World Food Program, in just 2 years, the number of people facing or at risk of acute food insecurity increased from 135 million in 53 countries to 345 million in 79 countries in 2023. Two major events are driving this crisis. According to Kerry Fowler, the United States State Department Special Envoy for Global Food Security, climate is certainly one of them, said Dr. Fowler. We've had 532 consecutive months in which the global average temperature for the month exceeded the 20th century average. What's worse, for the past 2 years, we have benefited from the La Nina cooling weather phenomenon. But in 2023, we lost that advantage.
We're now going into an El Nino period, a warming trend that typically affects tropical countries more than temperate countries. In other words, this is not business as usual for agriculture.
Russia's war in Ukraine is the second major driver of food insecurity, particularly Vladimir Putin's decision to pull out of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, said Dr. Fowler. What are the impacts on the degrading Ukrainian agriculture and export by Russia?
The top 15 importers of Ukrainian grain are a number of developing countries with quite high percentages of childhood stunting. The majority of countries on Earth are, in fact, net food importers. 131 out of 196 countries are net food importers.
Countries in the global south really need our help in terms of developing their agricultural food systems. They need strengthened food security, said Dr. Fowler. One of the more promising possibilities is the Vision for Adapted Crops and Soils program, co-sponsored by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN and the African Union, said Dr. Fowler.
We're working with African governments to identify the traditional and indigenous crops that have the most potential for adding to nutrition in Africa. We are assessing how they are likely to perform in climate-changed Africa, which we can see already. And this will provide the basis for our working with African countries in crop improvement programs for those crops.
We're taking a long view of trying to address the food insecurity problems, said Dr. Fowler. We do not need to be taking grain and food off of markets. We need to be helping countries strengthen their food security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.